Please give a very, very warm welcome to Paul Michelli with EPA.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your warm welcome. And actually, it is a pleasure for me to be back at ACE. I don't think I've been at an ACE conference now for a couple of years, but I remember fondly trips to Omaha in the middle of the summer as well. You guys always schedule your meetings at just the best time of the year. And it's actually been a very pleasure for me to work with Brian over the years. You've got a really good person there here at ACE, Ron Lamberty as well. And Shannon, I've seen over the years as well. It's just been a nice relationship with you guys. I don't have a prepared PowerPoint presentation, which is unusual for me, because mostly I'm here to touch on a number of, you know, just updates on what we've been doing, and then I'll probably open it to some time of question and answer afterwards. I've left my cell phone on while I'm talking, so hopefully that's not too rude, because if I get a call for an announcement during the course, it's you know, I'm working on the 2014 annual standards, and maybe there's something to announce there, but the main reason is I'm going to be a grandfather in the next couple of weeks or next week or so, so if I get the call, I'm going to take it, okay? To kick it up, I'm going to run through the 2014 annual standard a little bit, the 2013 compliance extension that was just announced again, touch on the 2015 standard that we should be working on already, pathways, QAP, Tier 3, and some other things. First of all, the 2014 annual standards, I think I heard you guys referring it to the RVO rule now. We still call it the 2014 annual standards. It is an incredibly important rulemaking for us, and as well as for you, and we're working on it as hard as we can to try to get it out the door as soon as possible. I can't say when it's going to come out, in large part because that will depend in large part on the review time when it does get into the interagency review process. For the rulemakings, we work on them. It leaves EPA, gets uploaded, goes over the Office of Management and Budget. They send it out to other agencies for review. That review period can take anywhere from 30 to 90 days, 60 days sometimes. I don't know what they're going to do with this one. So we'll actually, when it does come out, we're hoping they're going to, when they do get it, that it will be expedited. But that's sort of out of our control. What I can say is while we're waiting for it to get sent over to OMB, we are also working very hard still on the rulemaking. We were blessed with 300,000 comments on this rulemaking. And so with that, not only do we have to finalize the rulemaking, but we have to respond to the comments that we received. And right now, me and my staff are working on that. The document currently stands at over 2,700 pages, which is about a half of a box of paper. So it's a rather large task that we've got in front of us yet. Very recently, and actually while I was out of the office last week, there was an announcement of another compliance deadline extension for the 2013. We had hoped that the 2014 standards would have been finalized by now. I had hoped that it was going to be finalized several months ago. That's not been the case, so as a result, we have once again extended the compliance deadline for obligated parties, simply so that they know what the standards will be for 2014 before they make their final decisions on buying, selling, trading, holding RINs for 2013. The 2015 annual standard is something that normally we would have proposed by now. We should have had it proposed probably by June in order to have it finalized by the statutory deadline of this November. That hasn't happened in large part because we've been trying to get the 2014 rulemaking out the door. We're hopeful that, as soon as we get 2014 out the door, we will be following suit as quickly as we can with 2015, and then hoping that we can move that to final rule a little faster than we were for 2014 if we can get some of the issues sorted through with 2014 final rulemaking. Our ability to move on to the 2015 standards will depend on, in large part, on how much time me and my staff have to devote to the litigation on the 2014 standards that we have already been guaranteed we will receive from several of the stakeholders. So we'll see how all that plays out. While we've been working on the annual rulemakings, which is my main focus, other parts of our office have been working on the pathways rulemaking. If you follow this at all, the new Pathways 2 rule was published on July 18th. Did three main things. It first approved several new pathways, mostly related to biogas, CNG, LNG, and electricity made from biogas from various digesters, as long as that fuel is used as transportation fuel as required by the Act. Second, it clarified some things with respect to cellulosic feedstocks, that as long as it has 75% cellulosic content, we qualify the fuel, the entirety of the fuel produced from it as cellulosic. As the industry has continued to evolve since we first finalized RFS, processes change, so some of these things become key issues or questions to go forward implementing the program. And likewise, in there we provided new guidance concerning feedstocks that we consider to be crop residues. What is a waste? What is a residue? Become very important questions and answers as we get into some of these feedstocks and fuel pathways. Including in that was crop residues for corn kernel fiber. We also, back in, I think, March, announced an initiative to try to streamline the pathways process. This has become a process that's approving new fuel pathways for the RFS. It's been a process that has been very time-consuming and cumbersome for us and frustrating for the industry. So we've been trying to take a step back and say, what can we do to try to streamline the process, both going forward for new feedstocks as well as for some of the updates to some of the pathways that have already been approved? That's work that's already underway, and we hope to have some new guidance out in the next couple of months. Also on July 18th, the Quality Action Plan, or QAP rule as we refer to it, was published in the Federal Register. That was initiated back in 2012, a result of some RIN fraud in the industry. Largely, by the time we finalized the rulemaking, most of the problem had apparently addressed itself through more diligent oversight of the marketplace on the part of the obligated parties. A lot of the main issues at the time were who's going to make up for the RINs that were declared invalid. That's now been dealt with mostly as well by being written into contracts between renewable fuel producers and obligated parties, as well as even before the rule was final, a number of companies began as third-party auditors to verify the validity of RINs, and that has helped, I think, as well to sort of stabilize the marketplace. This is mostly an ethanol crowd, but most of that has been on the biodiesel side. I think about 78% of the RINs that had been gone through the auditing process up till very recently, were all biodiesel RINs, and that comprises about 11% of the biodiesel market. So not a lot of other stuff other than biodiesel has actually gone through the process. While you may think that all we have to do is work on RFS, that's not the case. So back in April as well, we announced another major new rulemaking that I was in charge of for Tier 3 vehicle and fuel standards. It was fought over very vociferously by the oil industry. But at long last, in April, after a few years worth of effort, we were able to finalize that. It set more stringent vehicle standards for the auto companies, as well as more stringent gasoline sulfur content requirements for the oil companies. That's a rule that's going to have tremendous air quality benefits to the American public. And amazingly, in a time when we are, you know, sued on everything, including when I sneeze probably in a few minutes, neither the auto industry, nor the oil industry, nor the states, nor the NGOs sued us on that rulemaking. Unfortunately, the ethanol industry did, or at least a affiliate of it. The Energy Futures Coalition sued us on that. We're still waiting to hear exactly what their statement of reasons or what their basis is. So we'll see how that plays out. But that is a rulemaking that that I was very happy to get off my desk and out the door. One thing we did not finalize with that Tier 3 rulemaking that we had sought comment on in the proposal was the standards for higher level ethanol blends. That's something that we're continuing to look at right now, now that Tier 3 is over. It's something that whether an FFE is running around on E10, E15, E30, E50, E85, the fuel still needs to meet the same fuel quality standards of sulfur, RVP, benzene, to make sure that the vehicles are still meeting their emission standards in use and that we're getting the air quality benefits from our vehicle standards. So that's something that we're still looking at moving forward with. And I'm hopeful that we can move forward with that because I think it'll also help streamline the pathway for more people to start producing and distributing higher-level ethanol blends. That's my rundown of the main things that are on my plate at the moment. So I really open it up for questions at this point.
I'm concerned, and those of us who are around blender pumps, you know, most of the E30 that's sold is sold to standard vehicles just by the sheer volume we sell, and it's based on price. If the spread is there, the first thing people look at is price, and then they probably never look at their owner's manual. So why the two big myths holding back the ethanol industry, costing South Dakota a lot of money, because E30 is about 50 cents less than unleaded. That's $200 million a year for South Dakota standard auto owners. So EPA always says, well, it may harm your engine. And it's the same engine that's found in a flex vehicle. And it may ruin your warranty, but that's a function of federal law called the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act. So I'm asking EPA to not tell standard auto owners it may harm your engine and it may be illegal. Please comment.
Trying to figure out how to answer that. In large part, it's not EPA telling people or not. The pump labeling is more related to E15, and that is sort of a labeling requirement because weren't able to grant a waiver to every single gasoline-powered engine and vehicle out there. But in large part, we don't get into the warranty issues. When we granted the Clean Air Act requires, EPA, what we do is we implement the Clean Air Act. We don't do legislation. That's Congress's job. We do regulation, and Congress has given us certain authority. So when we got a request for the Clean Air Act requires that all fuel used in gasoline vehicles be substantially similar to the fuel in which the vehicle was certified. must contain just carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and sulfur, and then it has you get into the limit on how much oxygen it could contain, and E10 and all that history. The waiver for E15 went through a process of, we got a request, we went through the process of the data that was provided to us to approve a waiver for E15. To do so for E20 or E30 or anything else for a conventional gasoline vehicle would require us to go through the process again, looking at mostly from an emissions standpoint, will that fuel cause vehicles to violate their emission standards in use? That's our responsibility. As far as vehicle warranties are concerned, that's really up to the vehicle manufacturer.
You mentioned the Pathways 2 ruling is out.
Where am I looking?
Right here.
Sorry, okay.
You mentioned the Pathways 2 ruling is out. And that ruling is not final yet, is it? That's a proposed rule?
No, Pathways 2 is final.
Okay.
That was the final.
In Pathways 2, you mentioned the biogas to electricity.
Right.
And that electricity has to be used in electric vehicles to qualify?
It has to be used in transportation. The RFS program, as given to us by Congress, is for alternative or renewable fuels used in transportation. So that's why everything we've done with natural gas, even before that, before Pathways 2, it still has to be a fuel that's used for transportation. The only exceptions in the statute provided were if it's used as heating oil or, I think, marine. There were two exceptions.
Do you have an estimate for how many cellulosite gallons equivalent that ruling would generate today?
The Pathways 2, you mean?
With using an electrical vehicle as the...
Oh.
Because you had numbers in there saying how many gigagrams of carbon go to electricity. Do you have a feeling for how many cellulosic gallons that would be equivalent to?
I'm sorry, I'm not quite understanding the question.
Well, the rules are based on so many gallons, so the 5 billion gallons of cellulosic ethanol, the RFS2 type stuff. Now that electricity qualifies effectively as that type of fuel, do you have an estimate?
I gotcha.
Did you do calculations to project how much cellulosic fuel currently theoretically be on the marketplace?
Yeah, I don't, as I stand here, I don't know what the numbers might be exactly for that specific pathway of biogas to electricity. I do know that in our 2014 final rulemaking, we have estimates of how much cellulosic either just used directly as biogas for CNG or LNG. I don't know if electricity was part of, if it showed up in the calculation or not, but we already had estimates in the proposal because biogas already qualified as advanced. It just didn't have the cellulosic pathway. So the main change is it shifted from advanced to cellulosic. So we have new estimates that will be coming out in the final rule for how much in 2014, and then we'll be estimating again for 2015 through these new pathways we'll be qualifying.
All right, thank you.
Morning. I don't know if this is working or not.
Yep.
Okay. My name is Scott Parsley. I'm on the ACE Board of Directors, but I also work for a rural electric cooperative. And I'm going to make a comment or a statement. I don't really have a question, but I'd like you to take this back. I know you work in the transportation side, but the two places that carbon comes from is fuels and coal. And we know today that about 60% of that carbon in the air comes from transportation fuels. Yet EPA continues, it seems to us, in this process of the renewable fuel standard, to put roadblocks up in front of something that will reduce that carbon, while on the other hand, something that this industry depends on vitally, which is electricity, we've decided that we're going to take some rather stringent or strident approaches to reducing carbon and electricity. And I'm not arguing with you about whether we should reduce carbon or not. What I am arguing about is the confusion that that sends to this industry and to others, that on the one hand, when we have an opportunity to reduce carbon, it seems to us that the EPA puts up roadblocks, but yet wants to increase the cost of one of our biggest inputs, which is electricity, to manufacture a product that will reduce carbon. So I just ask that you take that back to your offices as you discuss this and express the confusion and the frustration that we have out here. You heard in Brian's opening remarks that we're quite frustrated with the EPA right now on a lot of fronts. And I think a lot of that is just self-created by the EPA, and maybe not talking to each other within the halls, but from the outside it looks like there is a significant contradiction going on. Thank you.
No, thanks. Let me just, I know you didn't ask for a response, but I like back and forth Q&A, so what can I say? I very much appreciate the dialogue that we've had over the years with especially ACE. I felt that Brian and even before Brian, that we've always been able to have very good dialogue back and forth with ACE on things, and I hope that continues out in the future. I will say, I'm not the agency's expert on everything that we're doing greenhouse gas related, but I will say that it's a fairly recent development for the agency to be able to regulate CO2 and greenhouse gases. That was the result of a Supreme Court decision, I think in 2009, but I can't remember now exactly. And we've been very aggressively moving forward with that. So that's why we've now set the second round of vehicle emission standards to reduce greenhouse gases from vehicles. We've been implementing the renewable fuel standard as best as we're able to, and I know there's various opinions on that, but to reduce greenhouse gases from the fuels that are used in those vehicles. And just recently the agency announced also trying to reduce greenhouse gases from power plants electricity generation. That's going to continue into the future, looking at non-road sources, aircraft sources, marine sources, other sources of greenhouse gas emissions. We spent 40 years focusing on mostly the other pollutants, and then the new thing that we're now focusing a lot of our effort on is the greenhouse gases. Our office right now is working on a second round of standards for heavy-duty trucks. That's a primary focus of ours across the whole transportation and our sister office, the stationary source sectors.
Good morning. My name's Rick Schwark. Question. I think everyone knows the future of fuel and engines are high-octane, low-cubic-inch engines. And to get there, we need to go from E15 to E20 to E30. The RVP of both E10 and E15 are identical. Technically, there's no difference. So why do we have these impediments put in place by the EPA around the RVP? Could you please address that?
I could go on for about 2 hours, but that probably wouldn't be helpful right now. The impediments aren't being put up by EPA. The impediments, again, come back to us trying to implement the statute as Congress has given to us and trying to figure out how can we move forward. And the whole question of the RVP is one that I personally have been dealing with since I started at EPA. I drafted the very first rulemaking. My very first rulemaking was gasoline volatility control, where we gave the 1 PSI waiver to E10 that was then codified by Congress subsequently. We are implementing the statute, and this is an issue that we've been having dialogue with, and I expect to continue to have dialogue with over the last several years, especially since E15 came on the scene. And quite frankly, I welcome ongoing dialogue with ACE and the rest of the industry on how can we move forward, because it's not us trying to put up roadblocks. It's us trying to figure out how can we move forward. And if we can't give a 1 PSI waiver-free 15, what can we do? Or if we can't do this, what else can we do? Because we're not trying to put up roadblocks. We're trying to move forward. I've got an RFS program that I have to implement, and it'd be a whole lot easier if I could just say, you know, numbers that Congress gave us are really easy to meet. Go do it.
Thank you for your questions, and let's thank Paul for joining us today.